You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of June 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
Now I'm going to take a moment later tonight and the days ahead to fully absorb the history we've made here.
Hillary Clinton becomes the first woman nominee of a major party in the US presidential race. My guests, Daniela Peled and Tim Marshall, will assess this and the day's other top stories, including...
That would be disastrous if one older generation were settling the future of the young. So it's very important we get people engaged, they do vote.
Vince Cable describing the difficulty of capturing the youth vote will delve into the UK's EU referendum debate. Plus, is France ready for Euro 2016? And how New Balance is at the finish line of its marathon race against the US Senate. That's all ahead here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to Midori House and to my guests. Today, Tim Marshall and Daniela Peled. Tim Marshall's a foreign affairs analyst and editor of the whatandthewhy.com. And Daniela Peled's the acting managing editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. A warm welcome both back to the programme.
Thank you.
Good to have you with us. Let's start in the United States, where President Barack Obama has congratulated Hillary Clinton on securing the nomination as the Democrat candidate.
Thanks to you, we've reached a milestone. The first time in our nation's history that a woman will be a major party's nominee for president of the United States.
Hillary Clinton addressing a crowd of enthusiastic supporters in Brooklyn, Daniela, historic milestone, she says. Is this more, I guess at this stage in the race with the miles left to run, is it more than merely a symbolic moment?
No, I mean, it's a very real moment. I mean, this is it. This is it. And now we're all going to be treated to this sort of not very wonderful spectacle of people dancing around endorsement, not endorsement. When is Bernie going to give up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not that excited about the fact that a woman has won de facto the nomination. She's a little bit of a hard candidate to be enthusiastic about. I saw a rather wonderful cartoon today. Contrasting 2008, yes, we can, with Obama, something like 2016. Well, I suppose we have to with Clinton. So you know, it's the inevitable. The inevitable has happened, and now we have to see how Bernie reacts. And I'm feeling a little bit nervous about what he's going to do now.
Well, before we think about what Bernie might do next, what about the fact, as Hillary mentioned there, Tim, you know, it's a historic moment of sorts. Does it, though, rather more remind us that the US has been, it's been a long time coming, and it's kind of inexplicable, really, that it's taken until 2016 to have a female nominee for this?
Well, I think it is explicable. I think it's basic sexism. And it's true of most countries. There's 193 countries. 22 of them have women heads of government or heads of state. 80% of the US Congress is male. I also think it is meaningful. I mean, I don't particularly care for Mrs. Clinton. Her voice just is like chalked and fingernails down a blackboard for me. You know, she's going to be incredibly hawkish, I think, if she gets in as president. But I think it is quite a moment. Not quite the moment it'll be that if she gets the presidency, and it is up there with Barack Obama. These things do matter. They the symbolism of them matters because it changes how people think. It does, this thing about highest, hardest glass ceiling, which is her quote, she has broken through one of those highest, hardest glass ceilings. She's now got another one to go. And once you've broken that ceiling, people say, oh, it's just less of a big deal. Now, I don't think there's going to be another black president for quite some time. If she's the president, there probably won't be another woman president. We haven't had a prime minister female since Margaret Thatcher in this country. But you do break those ceilings. They do need breaking, and it's on its way to being broken.
Daniela, if Tim's right, and it comes down to basic, you know, sexism, should we be worried? People are already talking about, you know, the spectre of Trump potentially winning, and that, you know, registered Democrat voters might go to Trump because they're so disillusioned with the process, and if they lose their anti-establishment man in Sanders, then they might go that way. If this is a country that has such a problem with sexism, could that genuinely prevent Hillary from winning in November?
I don't think so. I think what will prevent Hillary winning is that she's not a very likeable person. She's not a very passionate candidate. She's got an enormous amount of baggage. Yeah, and I think sexism is an issue, but I am already wishing that she would sort of stop going on about the fact that this is a historic moment because she's a woman.
Like, that's quite soon, Daniela, on the actual day.
Well, no, I mean, this has been part of her whole shtick for a long time, but it's a fact. It's like Sadiq Khan, the new mayor of London. I kind of wish he would stop talking about being a Muslim as well, because that's not really
and the son of a bus driver,
exactly. I mean, that's not why many people voted for him. Okay, we get it, but I don't think that's why many people voted for Clinton either. Mm-hmm. You know, and the fact there hasn't been a female British prime minister since Thatcher, I don't think is a sign necessarily of that we wouldn't vote for a woman, but the right candidate hasn't come up. And okay, that could be, and that probably is because of endemic sexism as well. But it's not a single issue. It's not, and I wish we could focus. I would like to focus on other things already.
I agree with you about the actual vote split, but it's the system and it's the political climate. And if the political climate is unfriendly to women going into politics, you will therefore have fewer women candidates. Consequently, you will have fewer who will get to the very top. So I think how many American men, and indeed some women, will say to themselves, you know what, I don't know if I'm going to trust a woman in the White House. I read just today, there's some famous rapper who said, oh, well, you know, they can be a bit hysterical. Some people still think like that. Oh, finger on the nuclear button. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's funny, but they have
a
vote.
I'm laughing more at your impression of the famous rapper, but okay.
He was from Yorkshire.
Well, let's talk a bit about Bernie then, Daniela. You're keen to sort of move this on, so let's do exactly that. And you raised this question about his refusal to step aside. Now, it's hard to second guess what his agenda might be. We see this often in these races in the US, that you have the others, even the candidates, once it becomes apparent that they can't win, they jockey. What kind of position, what kind of strength can they, how can they strengthen their own hand for, say, a big job if the result goes the right way in November? What's his game? What's his game plan? He's been hard to read. Do you see that changing?
Well, what worries me, what's slightly heartbreaking really, is that he wouldn't be the first politician or the last politician to sort of be overwhelmed by narcissism and not know when it's time to stop. I mean, his part in the race has been very important. You know, he's changing the agenda, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But he has to know when's the time to stop. And he's not been particularly motivated by loyalty to the party and the ideals, the Democratic Party or whatever. I don't think he needs to stand down now, but he needs to stop in about a couple of weeks' time. The idea that he's going to fight on till July is a bit tragic. He can step down. It's not when he steps down, it's how he does it. Mm. And like I said, Clinton isn't the most exciting, wonderful and sort of heartwarming candidate, but the fight against Trump needs to be united.
She's not Trump. Do you think Sanders risks undoing some of the good work that he's done, that some would say, i.e. causing a bit of a re-evaluation, maybe bringing back some kind of notion of, I don't know, socialist-ish policies on the Democrat side, a shift to the left, people say? If he stays around like a bad smell, does he risk undoing that?
Well, I think he does. I mean, the idea that though Trump is and he did blatantly appeal to Sanders supporters, saying, hey, you know, you've lost your established anti-establishment candidate. I can be your anti-establishment candidate. It's kind of ludicrous, but actually it does point up the fact that Clinton really does need that kind of more left-wing support now. And there is a real risk that a lot of the pro-Bernie people are just simply not going to vote now. And that would be disastrous.
Tim, on that point, it's interesting. I've talked to a few of our guests on this show and on others on Monocle 24 about, you know, where do the Sanders supporters go? And a lot of people say, well, no, you know, registered Democrats could vote for Trump. That's how far their ennui with, like, the political mainstream has taken hold. Do you think that how Sanders conducts himself in the next, I don't know, week, 10 days, will shape where those votes go?
It does matter. I mean, he won several states, millions of people voted for him, and now I agree with Daniela for the first time in my life. I agree with Daniela. It does matter what he says, because there is a potential for lots of people just to stay at home, a plague on both your houses. If you take the view that Donald Trump is not the sort of responsible character that perhaps should be in charge of the world's superpower, which is a view that has been expressed by some people, but many people in America think complete opposite and may vote him in as president. But if you take the view that he's not, and Sanders clearly takes that view, there is a responsibility to say, look, we fought the good fight. This super PAC argument, basically he's just saying, look, if the super PACs all come for me, that'll swing it. But you know, everyone knows they're not all going to go for him. So he has to bow out gracefully, pull in that percentage of his vote and say, transfer it.
Can he convince them, Daniel?
He can convince some.
Well, I think he can. You know, it's about his conduct now, and Obama has given him again another way to do this gracefully. He's going to meet him tomorrow. He's acceded to his request to Sanders' request for a meeting. Clinton has been quite gracious. Sanders has not been very gracious so far. So there is that opportunity. I would love to see him involved in a future administration. That would be great. That would be actually a positive move. And I don't think he needs
to... Does that become more or less likely, depending on what happens now?
Yeah, I mean, I think without a doubt. You know, Clinton did step down fairly graciously when Obama won. I mean, notably graciously. And I don't think that was the reason why she went on to have this position in the administration. Not alone. She is a woman of very great talent, even though, as I mentioned before, not terribly likable. But I think Sanders needs to make that clear. He needs to show a little bit of loyalty and a little bit of like greater good at this point.
Just finally on this, Tim, before we move on, a lot of the narrative has been about, you know, the failure to get anything to stick to Trump, and we had Clinton's big foreign policy speech last week, and we got a tirade of misspelt abuse on Twitter from Trump again. Nothing, I think he went up a couple of points. Does what happens with the way the Democrat movement conducts itself, could that change that? Could it change the ability of Hillary to do any damage to Trump? Or are we still in this world where the Trump phenomenon is completely without the conventional political experience?
No, they're, like in every country, there are wavering voters. And if you want to win them over, they're usually towards the centre. And if you conduct yourself the way that Trump and some of his supporters have conducted themselves, you're hardly going to win over the waverers, because there have been some unpleasant scenes, and it's not all Trump supporters that are behaving badly. So I think it matters how she behaves, assuming it's her, how they conduct themselves, and how you have to put yourself into opposition of what he is. And everything that he is, you have to say, I am not. So if you start using the same type of emotive language, and your supporters start behaving in the emotional way that some of his do, I don't think you're positioning yourself in opposition to everything that he stands for. I mean,
but that strikes me as interesting, Tim, because a few people I've spoken to said, oh, well, this shouldn't be about positioning yourself in opposition to Trump.
Well, it always
is. The necessity is positioning yourself on your principles, and that, you know, the rest will follow. But you think counter to that?
I think you always have to know what it is that you are against and stand up for it. I mean,
broadcasting what you're about, it's about what you're not.
No, they go hand in hand. But you must position yourself against that, because it's very rarely been as stark as it is at the moment. I know you want to move on, but there is the issue of what Bill Clinton would be called. And he's going for Adam, the first man. He is. Hey, it's his joke, not mine.
it's his dad a joke. There's dad jokes could ever be.
I like a dad joke on the Dory House. Let's move on. The big kickoff is just days away. But is France any better positioned to host the European Football Championships than it's looked in recent weeks? Industrial action, states of emergency, a general political impasse, plus the threat of terror attacks, with the events of last year in Paris, of course, still fresh in the mind. It's been a pretty moribund atmosphere. Daniela, is there any sign of a little sunshine on the horizon? Probably not. Of course, we've had literally floods added to the list of problems. It seems like a sort of kind of biblical curse raining down.
Steady on
the country. Well, no, but it's one plague after another. Is this a country that just is not ready for the global focus or the European focus that's coming?
It's not, but that's part of France's charm. I don't think anyone visits France for a sporting event or a cultural event and expects everything to run according to plan and all the trains to be on time and everything. No, they want to enjoy a nice beer, a nice glass of wine, some fantastic food. And, I mean, again, I'm speaking now as a sort of red-faced Brit with a knotted hanky on my head, but you don't expect to go to France and then not be somebody on strike. I mean, you know, hey, it's part of its global brand in a way. And even more seriously, I think the strikes reflect a very long-running and very serious problem at the heart of the French economy about reform and about moving forward, about tackling unemployment, about making it easier to fire people, which also makes it easier to hire people. But also this, I think, the strikers are getting increasingly unpopular, even amongst the trade union. So I don't expect there to be massive disruption when it comes to that. And when we're talking about the threat of terror, well, you know, hey, is that really going to put anyone off going to see football? Tim, football fan?
It's the new normal. You just, like everything else, you get on the tube every day, you do this, you do that. It's the new normal. That's the terror side of it. They are going to be stretched. And they're going to be stretched because there's 90,000 security officers that are going to be deployed right across the country in all the different stadiums. But it's because they now have a state of emergency in 728 towns and villages because of the flooding. And so the emergency services are stretched there. The strikes are also stretching the security services, and it's going to bleed over into the beginning of the championships when the railway workers goes on strike. And so you're going to have several hundred thousand extra people all trying to get around the city, the country at a time when the trains may be on strike. It's going to be a challenging time. And then just towards the end of it, the Tour de France kicks in as well. There's an overlap. So we're going to see if French efficiency is efficient.
Well, I know, Tim, we spoke, I think, a week or so ago, and you were sharing some of your concerns about the security situation, this sort of unpoliceability of all of these events. But just on that point that Daniela raised about, and again, we touched upon this before, about, you know, these very significant structural changes that are needed and the general political gloom that's kind of hangs over the country. If things go rather better than people are expecting, who knows, maybe if France win this tournament, is that a bit of a get-out-of-jail-free card, potentially, for François Hollande? Do you think that this is one of those things that could galvanise? We saw it with Greece going back, whatever, 15 years. Yeah. It had a seemingly transformative effect. Does sport retain that power?
Yes, it does. I mean, you go back a bit further when the French national side won the World Cup and then the European Championships, and it was with that incredibly talented multiracial team, and it really did lift, and to an extent, unite the nation. It didn't last that long, but it did have that power.
They got about a decade out of it.
Yes, and it's over. They are completely ripped asunder at the moment, it seems, on a racial level, particularly between Muslims and non-Muslims in France. And I actually will... They're going to be my fourth choice team for that very reason. England, then Iceland, then Northern Ireland, and then France. I'll end up backing France.
I don't want this to become a football phone-in, though as fun as that would be. I sense you're slightly joking there. Tim has a broad grin on his face.
I have a sort of sneery
Daniela
grin.
Daniela just looks slightly confused by... Who's your tip then, Daniela, by the way?
Somebody's going to be playing something? Sports ball.
It's not sports ball, Daniela. I've spoken to you about this before.
Football matters, sports matters, it transcends things. Look at Muhammad Ali. You want to move on now.
That's Tim Marshall and Daniela Peled. We'll have more from both of them here on Midori House. Stay tuned.
Whether you're thinking of founding your own nation or would like to make the one you live in a bit better, we have the book for you. The brand new How to Make a Nation, A Monocle Guide, is an informed and quietly provocative book about updating the art of statecraft. After 10 years of meeting inspiring citizens and on-it PMs, soft power influencers and smart architects, we'll tell you how to construct the perfect embassy, design a modern parliament, and even how to make the most of your national dress. This 340-page large format book delivers fresh thinking and lots of solutions too. It's a book about the small things that can make our nations work better for everyone that calls them home. Buy your copy today at monocle.com and all good bookstores. Go on, be the leader.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me, Tom Edwards, are Tim Marshall and Daniela Peled. The deadline for registering to vote in the EU referendum has been extended here in the UK. Now, while this sounds like a technicality due to apparent issues with the government website last night, the extra 48 hours might be exactly the window of opportunity needed to attract the all-important youth vote, which both sides of the campaign have been struggling to capture thus far. Let's hear an insight from the former British Business Secretary Vince Cable.
We know that large numbers of young people are not on the electoral register, for example. There is a real danger that older people who, for perhaps rather conservative, sentimental reasons, prefer the way it was in the past, may outvote younger people who are more relaxed about our continuing membership. And that would be disastrous if one older generation were settling the future of the young. So it's very important we get people engaged, they do vote.
Daniela, surely it shouldn't have been difficult, or it should not be difficult, to attract the youth vote in this country, particularly on an issue where seemingly they're largely of one voice, squarely in the Remain camp. And yet, it does seem that it's been tricky to galvanise them even into registering to vote. Why has that happened?
Well, it is always, to be fair, tricky to get young people involved in political campaigns, especially because political campaigns tend to be done by people who are
politicians,
and, you know, a decade or two decades older, and it's usually excruciatingly embarrassing, and they try and engage with the youth, and this time is no exception. I saw possibly the most excruciating video of my entire life. The Vote In campaign. Have you seen this? Vote In.
I've seen it and I'm still scarred by it.
Yeah, what young people like. Rappers, mobile phones, skydiving. Really, you know, head clutchingly awful. If that's the best they've managed, it's been pretty bad. And it is an opportunity wasted because young people will be more likely to vote in. I mean, I think Leave haven't even really tried to engage them because it's a losing battle. In general, though, I think we could confidently say that it reflects the general tone of the entire referendum debate and campaign, which is lacklustre and disappointing. And if Vince Cable is supposed to be the person to appeal to the youth vote, then I rest my case.
I find Vince rather a reassuring voice.
Very, very sleepworthy. Yeah.
Tim, you look slightly unconvinced by that. What's most surprising here? Is it that we still haven't found a way to crack this nut of getting, you know, young people engaged in politics in a more hands-on way? Or is it the generally risible attempt by, let's be fair, both sides to actually make this race, which is rather exciting, come across as that to younger voters, or any voters for that matter? It's been a pretty lacklustre campaign.
It's always been like that, though. I mean, I went back and looked at the figures for the British election last year. 18 to 24-year-olds, only 43% of them voted. Over 65s, 78% of them voted. That was in the general election. And that's the sort of figure that's going to be replicated in because younger people have got what they think are better things to do than be engaged in politics, which can be boring and dry, which is the second part of your question. When we try, once you've reached a certain age, to make it interesting, you're so far out of touch, you can't anyway. I don't think you should be doing, as Daniela said, this ridiculous vote in as opposed to voting, because politics is boring and dull and difficult and hard, and they are perfectly capable of grasping it and getting their heads around it. And I take issue with what you said about their speaking as one. 29% of the 18 to 34-year-olds in this country polled want out. Well, that's you know, getting towards a third. Over a quarter of young people want out. 53% want to stay in, which goes back to your original point. That's why the voting has been extended by 2 days. Basically, what happened, the Cabinet Office, which is the nerve centre of the British government system, completely failed to build a good enough website. Last night was the deadline for you to register to vote. 200,000 people went on it to try and vote, many of them young people, so they are engaged. The website fell over. At that point, the UK government has got to have to legislate new legislation, rush it through Parliament. I was in Parliament today talking to some MPs, and they were thinking, oh my God, you know, why can't they even get this right? And you can make the argument it's anti-democratic because clearly it will favour the in vote. I understand that argument, but I just think it's so important to vote. It's so important to register. I think, yes, all right, give the Cabinet Office a kicking, extend it by a couple of days, don't do it again.
Daniela, it strikes me as rather interesting. We look to a country like, say, Australia, where, you know, voting in, I don't know if all referendums, but certainly in general elections, is mandatory.
No, okay, it's only in all general elections.
In all big votes. Is it time for us to look at that then? Because there's clearly, as Tim points out, you know, if you've got several hundred thousand, a quarter of a million people waiting until the very last minute, they are paying attention. They may not be very well organised with their time. Time for something bolder? What about a requirement to participate?
No, absolutely
not. Isn't that what democracy is all about?
No, I don't think so. And I don't think it really suits our national character such as it is. You know, I find it quite reassuring that... government managed to balls up the website at the last minute. You know, I find it, we're sort of a little bit hapless, a little bit, well, come on now, do the sensible thing. I think British way of politics has always been about persuasion rather than mandatory anything. And I think this is another reason why we do really, really badly when it comes to fascist and far-right parties.
What was your figure? Something around 4 out of 10 voting in a general election. That's not really good enough, is it?
Well, no, 43% of...
It's fewer than half.
Fewer than half of people 18 to 24 bothered to vote in the general
election. 10 out is generally low. Well, it's about 60, less than 70%. But I think, again, that's something we have to deal with, and we have to try and explain to people, well, actually... It's quite a good idea to go out and vote. And I think with the referendum, we are missing a trick, because it's much a simpler choice. I think in the general roughy-tufty of political life, it's quite easy for younger people to say, oh, they're all as bad as each other. With in or out of the EU, I think it's a bit of a starker choice.
When you get older, you start thinking a bit more about money and about pensions and about foreign policy and about all sorts of, you know, inevitably more people are drawn towards the political agenda. Over 65s, 78%. Briefly going back to Australia, it isn't mandatory. They do get an awful lot of spoiled ballots, because you're allowed to spoil your ballot. If you don't show up to vote, apparently one of the criteria for you can write in and explain why you didn't is that you're dead.
Do they get many of those submissions each year?
No, but that genuinely is one of the reasons that you're allowed not to vote. You're dead or you were abroad.
I like that. Only in Australia, perhaps. Finally tonight, an almost decade-long marathon between New Balance and the US military. The Senate's currently debating a new bill on the brand of sneakers the military wear. The Boston-based New Balance Inc. has been lobbying the government to follow a law from the 40s. It's a sort of an esoteric piece of legislation. The Berry Amendment required clothing used by the military to be made in the US. Years later, a lack of options meant an exemption was made, and New Balance are trying to win the fight. I mean, Tim, this is quite interesting, only that you would imagine this would be quite an easy sell, wouldn't you, in a sort of fervently patriotic country like the US, clad our boys in shoes that are made here on US soil. Why would they not go back and reinforce this amendment?
Well, I was going to be facetious then and ask you to explain the story to me again, because I don't fully understand it, but I read up on it today. It is to do with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, where you are supposed to be able to outsource manufacturing, because it's all part of this free trade partnership. Nike are loving it because they make all their stuff in Vietnam and places like that. There are other US companies that say, hang on a minute, this law from 1941 that says footwear for the American military has to be made in the United States needs to be remain. And it is exactly what you said. It is the patriotism of our boys are wearing our shoes made in our country against the global movement free trade of the TPP. I have no idea who's going to win. I don't actually care. I will leave you with one fact. I'm writing a book about flags at the moment. It is also a US law that flags are supposed to be made, American flags are supposed to be made in America. Manufactured in America. They have these laws which are, you know, predate globalization.
So, Daniel, is that your reading of this as well? It's a sort of a quirk, and it's not surprising that there's, you know, trade and tariffs arguments going on, and there's this sort of patriotic call. But, you know, is there not a kernel of a good idea in here?
Well, actually, as I understand it, the person who's pushing this move hardest is the person who's, they don't have constituencies in America, but yeah, that's where the New Balance factory is. So it's kind of narrow interest. I'm not sure it will really also do much good in the long run for the New Balance brand, because that was always very much like, hey, our shoes are not made in sweatshops. But if it's also, you know, suppliers to the US military, you don't necessarily have the best reputation.
Just possibly. It could cause some problems for their overseas buyers.
Exactly.
There we must leave it. Daniela and Tim, thank you very much for being with us. As always, here on Midori House, the show is produced by Carlotta Rabello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Sai Villafuerta, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. We're back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours here in London. Do join us then. Goodbye.